Welcome to Unveiled Faces, a Redeemer Presbyterian Church podcast. Please enjoy our feature presentation.
This sermon today is a sermon that I began back in early September. This was not initially intended to be an Advent sermon, a Christmas sermon. In fact, it follows on the heels of the sermon from 2 weeks ago that dealt with Jesus as the high priest. You probably mentioned Melchizedek quite a few times in that sermon. If you've forgotten, that might jog your memory. You're going to hear some similar things, I think, because this sermon finds its roots in the chapter just before what you heard 2 weeks ago. Pastor Van Der Dusen preached on Hebrews chapter 7. I'm going to be focusing on the end of Hebrews chapter 6. So you're going to hear some similarities, but I hope that what you'll be able to do, and we'll turn this right now, just with the wave of my hands, it's now an Advent sermon. And what I want you to think about as... Is that distracting? Is that doing some weird stuff? Oh, okay. Let's see if that's better. Is that better? Okay. What I want you to imagine... No, it's still doing it. Okay, what I want you to imagine is, as we think about baby Jesus, we think about him as he was when he was born, a little baby, cute, I'm guessing, as babies often are most of the time, kind of weak, small, chubby. And yet, what I want you to think about is... What we're going to be talking about today is what that little chubby, cute Jewish baby became, what he came to do. Think about a baby with purpose, a baby who came with a purpose, with purpose. And so connect those two things today, and if we do that, we can make this an Advent sermon. So with that said, go ahead and please stand. We want to acknowledge with our bodies, this is just one of the ways that we do this in our culture, particularly of our church, of recognizing this is the Word of God. This is special. It's unlike any other words, no matter how beautiful or important they are. I'd like you to turn to Hebrews chapter 6. We're going to start with verse 9. We'll read through verse 20. And as we read, it's a nice chunk. There's going to be three major sections, the way that I'm breaking it up today. Verses 9 through 12 are the purpose for what he's hoping to accomplish in the lives of the hearers as he writes. Verses 13 through 18 are some of the reasons he gives for why he wants them to respond the way he's hoping. And then verses 19 through 20 are kind of a punch, a conclusion. So be thinking about that as we're reading together here. Hebrews chapter 6, verses 9 through 20. Though we speak in this way, yet in your case, beloved, we feel sure of better things. Things that belong to salvation. For God is not unjust so as to overlook your work and the love that you have shown for his name in serving the saints as you still do. And here's his desire for them. This is the emphasis of the first section. We desire each one of you to show the same earnestness, to have the full assurance of hope until the end, so that you may not, here's his desire, you may not be sluggish, but imitators of those who through faith and patience inherit the promises. There's his desire for them. The next few verses are why he hopes that they will respond in that way. He says, when God made a promise to Abraham, since he had no one greater by whom to swear, he swore by himself, saying, surely I will bless you and multiply you. And thus, Abraham, having waited patiently, obtained the promise. Because, you see, people swear by something greater than themselves, and in all their disputes, an oath is final for confirmation. So when God desired to show more convincingly to the heirs of the promise the unchangeable character of his purpose, he guaranteed it with an oath. So that by two unchangeable things, in which it is impossible for God to lie, we who have fled for refuge might have strong encouragement to hold fast to the hope that was set before us. And then the last section, the punchline. We have this as a sure and steadfast anchor of the soul, a hope that enters into the inner place behind the curtain where Jesus has gone as a forerunner on our behalf, having become a high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. Amen, and please be seated. So I'm going to really briefly review what we talked about back in early September, just so you get the context. That was the purpose of last sermon a few months ago, was to give you context for what we're going to talk about today. So let me briefly give that to you today. There's four parts of the review I want to focus on. Number one, that the goal of the author at this point, it was outlined in verses 11 and 12 in particular, where he says, "And we desire each one of you to show the same earnestness." He wants us to be earnest people. "To have full assurance." He wants us to be assured people. All the way until the end, he wants us not to be sluggish in our faith, but rather imitators of those who through faith and patience inherit the promises. So he wants us earnest, fully assured, not sluggish, faithful people, and patient. Patient until the end. That's number one. Number two, he's writing to people who, for three reasons, struggle with this. He's writing because this is an actual struggle. Because of the pain that they're experiencing, because of the persecution that they're experiencing, and because of the impatience that they're experiencing, he writes the things that follow. In fact, throughout the whole book of Hebrews, he says things like this. Don't drift away. Don't harden your hearts. Now, keep in mind, he's not saying this so much as like some of you have recently or relatively recently joined the military. Hoo-yah? I don't know what the army says, but hoo-ha? There you go. Hoo-ha! Okay, so you joined the military and you got people who are telling you what to do all the time. Is that right, Angelo? Okay, yeah. That's not the tone of this letter. The tone of this letter is not a drill sergeant who's saying, you better not, you better not, you better not. It's the tone of a father, of a friend, who somebody cares about you, who wants your best, who's saying, who knows what will happen if you don't follow what he's saying, you're going to experience death. And so he's saying, don't drift away. Don't harden your hearts. Don't turn away. Don't fall short. Don't fall away. Don't throw away your confidence. Follow the examples of this long list of people in Hebrews 12. Because the consequences, like battle, are eternal. They are significant. They are severe. And so this is a voice. The whole letter is a voice of somebody who loves the people to whom he's writing, who want their best. The goal isn't the accomplishment of some battle out here. It's you're the battle. You're the goal. He wants the best for the people he's writing. And so as we listen to these words and we apprehend them, we should listen to them as words for us, even though they weren't written to us. They are written for us. Okay, that's number two. Number three, this goal of assurance would be accomplished by pointing them to the certainty of the promise that was made. So, in Genesis 12, we're given the promise of a Redeemer. In Genesis chapter 15, three chapters later, that promise is confirmed with a covenant. In chapter 17, two chapters later, he confirms the promise again with a symbol of circumcision. And then in chapter 22, as this whole story unfolds, what should have been acceptable as just the promise of God, he has given as an oath, he has confirmed it with the symbol of circumcision, now he confirms it with an oath. And then lastly, the author of Hebrews says, look, if that's not enough, if his promise isn't enough, if the symbol of circumcision isn't enough, if the covenant isn't enough, if an oath isn't enough, let me remind you of something. God can't lie. So whatever he says about the promises of God can be believed and rested in, and you can have the assurance of your faith. And then he goes on to draw a contrast. And this is point four in review. He goes on to draw a contrast between the Old Covenant and the New Covenant. Because the Old Covenant, in large part, is a covenant that was meant to point to the reality that was coming. It was shadows that point to the reality of Jesus. And I used the analogy of shadow puppets. And if you looked at the wall where the shadow is being cast, and you can tell this is going to be a dog because it's got ears, it's got a mouth, a muzzle. And that's about it, though. A shadow gives you a sense. It gives you a part of the reality, but it doesn't give you the reality. You can't pet a shadow puppet. Well, I guess you could try. You could shadow pet it. But that's not the same. We just got a kitten yesterday. Or Hannah got a kitten. And I can tell you right now, it's super cute. And petting that kitten is far better, the reality, than any shadow kitten that you might be able to come up with. And so that's the point of the author as he goes through the whole book of Hebrews, pointing back to the shadows and then pointing to the reality in Jesus, pointing back to the shadows and pointing to the reality of Jesus, is to say, the reality is so much better, don't fall back. Okay? Does that review, does that make sense? Okay. So now, I want to focus on one aspect of the shadows, so that as we contemplate baby Jesus and why he came, we'll be able to better appreciate what he actually accomplished for you. As I was reading through the book of Hebrews in preparation for this sermon months and months ago, I ran across Hebrews chapter 8. So if you have a Bible and you can turn to it, I'd encourage you to turn to Hebrews chapter 8, verse 1. I'm going to skip a little bit in there. I'm going to go 1 and 2 and then to the end of 4 and 5. So we're skipping verse 3 just for the sake of time. This is Hebrews chapter 8. I want to point out something I thought was really interesting and helpful, and really made the text come alive and made the reality of what Jesus accomplished more amazing. So starting at verse 1, Hebrews chapter 8. Now the point in what we are saying is this. We have a high priest. One who is, now I want you to notice the tense of the verb here. One who is seated at the right hand of the throne. So it's not was seated, it's not will be seated, but it's the present tense, is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven. Where's the throne located that he's talking about? In heaven. So he's saying you've got Jesus seated right now in heaven at the right hand of a throne. A minister, that's Jesus, in the holy places. In the true tent. What do you think about that for a second? In the true tent. So, if you're not that familiar with the Old Covenant, the Old Testament, you had a tent that was set up in the Old Covenant, not like our tents that we would go camping in, big tent where worship took place. A portable temple, as it were. And he's saying that Jesus, right now, seated at the right hand of God, right hand of the throne, in heaven today, that he is ministering in the true tent. That the Lord set up, not man. There are priests, this is verse 4, there are priests who offer gifts according to the law. They serve as a shadow, a copy of the heavenly things. For when Moses was about to erect the tent, he was instructed by God, saying, see that you make everything according to the pattern that was shown you. So in this little text, you've got this picture of Jesus in the true tent, okay, in heaven, that the tabernacle, the tent in the Old Covenant, served just as a shadow of that true tent, a copy of the heavenly things, that when they made the tabernacle and then the temple in the Old Covenant, it was just it was made according to the pattern of what was actually taking place, what actually exists in a real sense, though I don't think physical, but a real sense nevertheless, in heaven. And so when you look at the temple or the tabernacle, you get a picture of something you couldn't otherwise see. You get a picture of something going on in heaven. So all these books about heaven and the white lights and kids who have these miraculous visions and so forth, funny thing is they never talk about a tent. When do they talk about the priest? When did they talk about the right hand of the throne? Well, I'd encourage you, stop reading those books. Take a look at this one. get a glimpse right now of something that took place and is taking place in heaven. So what did the temple do? Well, it served a number of purposes. And I'm going to use the temple or tabernacle interchangeably. The tabernacle preceded, came before the temple. The temple was a more permanent structure. They served the same purposes. And one of the purposes that I want to drive home today, it's the main point, is that the temple or the tabernacle provided access to God. It was a place of contact with God. Now the truth is that God is everywhere. But there was a special condescension, a special recognition of our reality as creatures with bodies located in space. And maybe for that reason, as well as others, he chose to use this language of this idea of residing in the center of the tabernacle or the center of the temple. If you wanted to go visit God, there's a real sense in which you could do that by eventually when the temple was erected, by going to Jerusalem, going up to Mount Zion, going into the temple, and there you could meet God. It was a place of access, of contact. And that could be good. But as soon as you would enter the temple, you'd realize that something was wrong. Something wasn't right. Because the way that the temple was structured was like kind of like a funnel. You know how if you're going to pour, especially me, who tends to be super spazzy and spill all the time, if you want to minimize the spills, you would take a funnel, and it's big at the top, and it gets smaller at the bottom, right? Well, the temple kind of served like that, or it was structured like that. Or maybe more like a series of filters that started where the big chunks get taken out at the top, and then medium chunks get taken out down below, and then the really fine things that you don't want in the final product are taken out later on. The temple served in that way. Because when you walked through the gates of the temple, the first place that you would enter was the court of the Gentiles. That's where pretty much everybody could go. You didn't have to be a Jew in order to enter this section of the temple. You did have to be, you couldn't be a leper, for instance. So even at the very outset, as you entered into the temple, that you immediately knew if you were a leper, there was something about this contact with God that was impeded. Something was getting in the way. So if you weren't a leper, but you were a Gentile, fine, you can go into the court of the Gentiles. But the next section, you really begin to realize that though the temple was to give us access to God, that there was something getting in the way of that access. Because on the pillars between the court of the Gentiles and the court of women, it was written in Latin, Greek, and Hebrew to make sure that pretty much everybody could read it. There was a warning Gentiles not to come any further or they would be executed. Okay, so, you know, you go anywhere new and it might feel unfriendly. You go to a new church and maybe it may or may not feel like you're welcome there. Well, I've yet to be to a church where you walk past a particular place and there's a threat of death written on the walls. And yet that was the reality. You enter into the temple. If you were a Gentile, you could go into the court of the Gentiles. And it was big, but if you wanted to go any further, you had to be a Jew. And so the court of court of women didn't mean it was only for women. It meant that was as far as the women could go. Okay, so you're a Gentile, you've got to stop at that point. You can't go any farther than the court of the Gentiles. If you're a Jew, you can go into the court of women. But if you're a woman, you can't go any farther. That's it. Sorry. The next court, or the next section, was the court of the Israelites. So if you were a male Israelite, you could go into there. And you see how it's getting smaller and smaller and smaller? Well, the court of the Israelites, if you were a male, you could enter there. But after that, it was only for the priests. The court of the priests is where the priests could enter. And then it got even smaller after that. Because you had the holy place. And fortunately, you could enter one every day, but only one person could enter once a day, and it had to be a priest. That's the holy place. And then finally, the center of the center of the center was the Holy of Holies. It was separated by a big, thick curtain. So every day that the priest would go in, he'd look and he could see the curtain. And he knew what was behind it. It was the Holy of Holies. And in the center of the Holy of Holies was the mercy seat. But he couldn't enter there. Only once a year, and only by one person once a year, that was the only time that anybody could enter into that place. So you start with pretty much everybody could enter into the beginning of the temple. But by the end, one person, once a year. And I want to describe to you what he had to do. If you ever are interested in the understanding how the temple worked, Alfred Edersheim wrote The Temple Ministry, and it's thick, and it's not like reading Harry Potter or Lord of the Rings. It's thick. But there's some really interesting insights as you begin to understand exactly what happened. And so this is what would take place on the Day of Atonement, the one day that the one priest could enter into the Holy of Holies. This is what had to take place. This is part of what had to take place. 7 days before the Day of Atonement, the high priest left his own house in Jerusalem and took up his abode in his chambers in the temple. Okay, so this was so serious that he needed 7 days to prepare for it. Rabbinical punctiliousness, that means a real care for detail and attention to detail. Rabbinical punctiliousness went so far as to have him twice sprinkled with the ashes of a red heifer on the third and seventh day of his week of separation, just in case he had unwittingly to himself been defiled by a dead body. Okay, so he leaves his house, he goes to the temple, but just in case somehow that he didn't realize it, he had been made unclean by a dead body, not only once, but twice during that week, he had to be sprinkled with the ceremonial washing, the ashes of a red heifer, to cleanse him ceremonially from that potential uncleanness. During that whole week, he had to practice the various priestly rites, the sprinkling of the blood, the burning of the incense, the lighting of the lamp, the offering of the daily sacrifice. And so the whole week he's practicing and practicing and practicing and practicing. This should kind of remind you of some of my kids have recently taken, or relatively recently taken, driver's tests. And, you know, you practice, and you practice, and you practice, and you still wonder, what am I going to do wrong when I get there? I failed it twice for the same reason. Some people learn really slowly. You practice and you practice, and then you wonder, am I still going to mess up? Am I going to do something wrong here? Some of you take tests too, and you work really, really hard, and you still wonder, what am I going to do wrong? That was what was going on by the high priest, because you couldn't make a mistake. So, as already stated, this is still Edersheim speaking, every part of that day's service devolved on the high priest, and he must not commit any mistake. We watched a movie, some of our family watched a movie recently about Alex Hommel. Anybody hear of Alex Hommel? That's a big fat no. So, none of you are rock climbers. Neither am I, but he did what's called free soloing. He does what's called free soloing, where you climb big walls with no safety at all. One would wonder why someone would do that, and there's a few reasons for it. I wouldn't recommend it, but something happens when you know you have no safety to your ability to focus. You are in the game. There's no sloppiness. You're doing absolutely the best you can, because when you are 4,000 feet in the air above a granite floor, and you make one mistake, you're dead. Alex Hommel climbed El Capitan. It was, I think, 3,200 feet straight up without any safety. Not recommending that. But he knew, and he knows, you can't make a mistake. You make one mistake, and you are dead. That's the attitude of the high priest as he's preparing to enter into the Holy of Holies, because the Holy of Holies represented contact with the triune holy God. And he knew, I can't make a mistake. And so he's constantly washing himself through the week, and he's constantly practicing. And then on the eve of the Day of Atonement, the various sacrifices, so the animals that he was going to interact with, that he was going to kill and sacrifice and do all that whole deal with, they were brought to him so he could inspect them and make sure he understood everything about the animal, so there was no surprises. And if you watch Alex Hommel during this documentary on his preparations and climb of El Capitan, there was a point where there's this one section that you always need help with. You always need the gear to help you get over, and he couldn't use that. And so he's up there in preparation. He's got safety on. He's got his harness. He's leaning back in. And he's got a toothbrush. And he's scrubbing this little section of granite, and he's touching it, and he's looking for just the right finger holds and just the right footholds that nobody had ever discovered yet to make this possible. He's getting intimately acquainted with this task that is before him, and that's what the priests were doing. They didn't want to make any mistake, no surprises. There wasn't room for error. Each time before changing his garments during the Day of Atonement, he bathed. Not in the ordinary place of the priest, so he didn't even go to the ordinary baths to bathe. He went to a special place to stay completely pure. Altogether, he changed his garments and washed on his whole body 5 times on that day, and his hands and feet 10 times. Five times he bathed, and his feet and hands 10 times. We have kind of a hard time understanding what it's like to view God in that way. In some ways, because, for good reason, because we have access into the throne. I mean, that's what we're going to be talking about in just a moment. But also because we just don't take the fear of God and His holiness seriously. So there's a good reason why we can have confidence, but there's a bad reason why we oftentimes are cavalier. And I've got 4 really quick examples. The first 2 are pretty silly, but I think will kind of get you to start feeling the way that we should be feeling about these things. When I was a kid, we were super poor. We shopped at Payless before there was a shoe source. The shoes were to the left of the potted plants, and they were totally uncool. But that's all we could afford. And so I never got the shoes that I wanted, because the shoes I wanted were never, you know, they weren't the cheapest shoes on the shelf. So I remember one time getting these white shoes, and you think, well, white shoes, that's great. But the white shoes were so white. And I knew that when I went to school, that they were going to be like a beacon drawing everybody's attention to my crummy shoes. And I don't know if it was like this for you guys, but it was like a status symbol. Everybody paid attention to your shoes, and if you didn't have the right shoes, it was a recipe for ridicule. It was like it suddenly gave everybody permission to point that out. It was like the big fat zit on the end of your nose, and they wouldn't let it go. And so I knew that the next day I was in for ridicule, because I was not up to the standard of my peers. And so I went out to the backyard, and I actually took them and I rubbed them in the dirt. My new shoes, I rubbed them in the dirt, because I knew that I was not going to be accepted, and I was in for ridicule if I went to school with those blaring white shoes. In the same way, when we consider going into the holy presence of God, when we look at ourselves and we realize I'm not up to snuff, we should realize I'm not up to snuff. We should have that sense of how can I go into God's presence? How I was kind of feeling with my peers. How can I go into their presence knowing that I'm not, the standard has not been met? That same level of discomfort in part should be there. Some of you know Seth Larson from CVP. He broke his front tooth. So there's a big chip in his tooth. It wasn't even that big, actually. Just a chip in his tooth. And he didn't want to smile until he got it fixed. That little blemish. And he knew that it would draw attention to something that was wrong with him. And so he didn't want to smile. And he didn't feel right until he got that fixed. My mom had really bad teeth for lots of reasons growing up. And she, for years, decades, didn't smile. For the same reason. Now, God doesn't care about our shoes, and he doesn't care about our smiles, like the perfect smiles, but he does care about us being perfect. And so the analogy isn't you got to have good shoes and you got to have a good smile. The analogy is that same discomfort that we feel when we realize we're not meeting the standard, we should have that when we enter into the presence of God. During the summer, I went, led a surf camp that some of you have been to. And while I was there, one of the pastors was at the church we stay was talking about a man. There's a lot of homeless people in the area of San Diego where we go, which actually has been a huge blessing because it gives us an opportunity to actually interact and share the gospel with folks who really, really are in desperate need. But one guy I didn't meet, but I heard about, he has a problem where he can't control his bowels. And because of that, he has a major, obviously, impediment. He doesn't want to interact with people. He doesn't want to go out. He doesn't want to be around people. He doesn't want to go to church because he so recognizes the imperfection of his body and is so afraid of the ridicule that so often accompanies this affliction. Many of you have read Rosaria Butterfield's book. I mention it quite frequently. And she talks about how when she finally, she was a woman, a very successful academic who met a Christian family and eventually through years of conversation and prayer realized she needed the gospel of this Jesus that she used to hate. She needed him. And so one day she came to church and she felt so conspicuous because she looked every part the lesbian, like all the stereotypes that you would imagine, the short hair, and she knew her lifestyle. And so she comes into this place and she's like, she knows she's not worthy. She feels so conspicuous. All of these analogies, in one way or another, I hope begin to get you thinking about what it would have been like for the high priest and what it should be like for us as we consider entering into the presence of God. When you enter into the presence of something that's someone who's perfect, there's no blemish, there's no spot, and you stink, and you know your imperfection, there should be that sense of discomfort and holy fear. And that's exactly what we see when we see people who actually enter into the presence of God in the Scriptures. In Isaiah 6, verses 1 through 5, Isaiah 6, starting right at the beginning, we see one encounter, just one of many encounters, where somebody actually enters into at least the partial presence of God. And here we read in Isaiah 6, "In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him stood the seraphim. Each had six wings. With two he covered his face, with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one called to another," calling out something that wasn't going to make him feel very good. "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." That's like saying you don't have the right shoes. Your tooth is broken. You're filthy. You're not holy. That's what the seraphim is declaring as Isaiah stands there. As Isaiah stands there, he hears, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. And the foundations of the threshold shook at the voice of him who called, and the house was filled with smoke. And I said, woe is me, I'm lost. I'm a man of unclean lips. I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. My eyes have seen the King of the Lord of hosts." In Isaiah 3, a very well-known moment in redemptive history, when the Lord saw that Moses had turned aside to see this burning bush, God called to him out of the bush, "Moses, Moses." And he said, "Here I am." And then God said, "Do not come near. Do not come near. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place you're standing on is holy ground." And he said, "I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of the God of Jacob." And Moses, what did he do? Does anybody remember? He hid his face. We're told he was afraid to look at God. In Hebrews 4, there's a what I think is a fairly, at minimum, sobering and maybe even frightening reality that the author of Hebrews tells us. He says, no creature is hidden from his sight. All are naked and exposed to the eyes of him to whom we must give account. Put yourself in the place of the high priest, the one guy who gets to enter into the Holy of Holies once a year. This is the God he gets to encounter. This is the God he gets to come into contact with. A holy God, a just God, a pure God. And like the shoes and the tooth and all the whole deal, he knows he's not worthy. He is not acceptable. And yet he's got to enter into this place, into contact with God. But that experience of entering into the Holy of Holies, that was just the shadow. Remember, the author of Hebrews is looking at the shadows of the Old Covenant and pointing us by the shadows, by the finger puppets, to the reality of the kitten or the puppy, right? In this case, the shadows of God's holiness. They're just the shadows, the little taste, the little appetizer in the picture of the temple. That's just the appetizer. He points to Jesus, the reality, but not just to Jesus. He points to the reality of what Jesus did. Jesus knew firsthand, because he had come from the very presence of God, without a veil, without anything separate. It wasn't just a vision of the holy God. It was actually God that he had spent eternity with. He knew intimately the holiness of God. He knew the judgment of God. He knew he knew at least that God was holy and just. He knew that better than any high priest, better than Moses, better than Isaiah, who just saw a vision. He knew better than anybody exactly what he was going to get himself into when he came as that little baby. And as he took on the mantle of the high priest, the job of the high priest, he knew more than anyone exactly what he was doing. He took on, fully knowing what it would take, the guilt of his people, and suffered the just wrath of God. And he entered into that whole process knowing exactly what it would take, knowing exactly the holiness of God. So as we're celebrating Advent right now, but I want to point you to the passion of Jesus, to the end of not the end of the story, but to the climax of the story. As Jesus is walking with a cross on his shoulder through Jerusalem toward the cross, the picture I get now is that what actually was taking place, and when I say actually, I don't mean that he didn't do that. He did do that. But there was something else that was going on. As he was marching through the streets of Jerusalem out to to Golgotha, I picture him now as walking through the temple toward the goal, the Holy of Holies, toward that altar. And as he's moving through the temple, it's the purity that was required is getting more and more and more, and the weight of what is required is getting more and more and more. As he's got that cross on his back and he's walking through the temple. And then he moves aside the curtain that separated, thankfully, a holy God from an unholy people. And as he's marching and as he's pulling away this curtain, he knows what he's bringing with him. He's entering into the presence of a holy God, and yet he's got your sin, your shame, your guilt, your perversion. He's got that on his back, marching toward the very place that you wouldn't want to be, knowing that you're not a holy person, knowing that you are impure. That's the one place you wouldn't want to be, and yet that's the one place he's taking your shame and himself with it on his back. That's the one place he's going. And he stepped through the curtain. And then what the high priest would have done would have been, there would have been a sacrifice of some sort offered, but he didn't offer a sacrifice. He offered himself. He was both the high priest who offered the sacrifice and the sacrifice itself. And so when the author of Hebrews talks about him being a better sacrifice, he is a better sacrifice and a better priest, willing and able to not only do but be it all. In Hebrews chapter 4, one of my favorite passages, we're told that God sits on a throne of mercy. But in that moment, the little baby Jesus came and he got the judgment seat so that you might have the mercy seat. He took the judgment that you might get the mercy. Fully knowing what he was doing as he walked toward that goal. And so we read, lastly, in verses 19 and 20, what inspired my desire to preach on this whole section in the first place. We have this hope, this promise of Jesus, this promise secured for us. We have it as a sure and steadfast anchor for the soul. A hope that enters into the holy place behind the curtain. Do you see that picture now? He's taking the cross through the curtain and sinking it down into the presence of God. And we have that hope in the promise of Jesus, in Jesus himself, as an anchor for our soul. I've had the opportunity over the past month to rock climb twice. I'm not a rock climber. I'm super afraid of heights. It's one of the reasons why I've done it recently, because I don't like that fear. But if you've ever had to, if you're at the top of a cliff or a rock and you've got your harness on and you've got your rope attached to safety, here's the rope, or here's the cliff going down like that. You're up at the top. You've got, and the rope is securing you, you've got to lean back. And there comes a point where that rope is going to sink like that, and you're going to go boop. And it is one of the, especially if you're afraid of heights, it's one of the scariest moments. The only way that you're willing to actually do it is if you trust the rope, but more than that, you trust like the people who've set up the rope, or that the rope is attached to. When you think now of this hope as an anchor for your soul, it is not an easy anchor to trust in until you trust in the person who holds the other end. Jesus went into the Holy of Holies. He sank the cross into the ground. It is secure. And then he says, your hope is that you are attached to that anchor, immovable. It will not move. But it takes time to trust, to learn to trust. I know when I've climbed that the person who's on the other side, who's in charge of my safety, is competent, he's engaged, he's got it. And it still is scary. But that anchor should serve for you in the midst of whatever trials and difficulties and imperfections and sin and struggle you might have, like an anchor would serve for a ship in the middle of a storm. Isn't it odd that he would take this very dry picture of a temple, of the Holy of Holies, there's no oceans anywhere near it, and he would use a nautical analogy. There's an anchor right there in the Holy of Holies, in the throne room of God. It's an anchor. And an anchor, if you've ever seen a storm when there's a boat attached to the anchor, the boat moves around, but the rocks over there are not going to touch it as long as it's attached to the anchor. And the beautiful thing about the anchor that Jesus set for you, if you trust in him, if you belong to him, if you've been attached to that anchor, you're not going anywhere, no matter what you feel. So many times when you're climbing a rock face, you feel like you're, well, actually, you do fall. And that's when you start to learn what it means to trust in your equipment, to trust what you're anchored to. You really don't, if you've never done that before, if you've never fallen and then felt the safety and security of the system that you're attached to, you'll never really trust it. It's only when you actually fall that suddenly you realize, oh, okay, I'm safe. I can fall and I will survive this. I will fall and I will not be hurt. So, as we conclude, I want to ask you, what fears do you have? What evidence is troubling you? In quotes. What experiences have you experienced? What weights are you burdened with today? What failures just so consistently call you to doubt? To doubt, to not trust in the anchor to which you're attached. I want to remind you of the promise of God. I want to remind you of what Jesus accomplished, that there is now an anchor for your soul. Stop hoping in your strength. Stop hoping in your perfection. Stop hoping in your works. Stop it. That is not the hope that you're pointed to in this text. The hope you're pointed to is Jesus and the anchor that he secured. That's what you trust in. That's where your security is. So as we celebrate Advent, as we celebrate the coming of baby Jesus, as you celebrate this Christmas, remember the beautiful reality of his birth. And that he began his life just like we do. But also remember what he came to accomplish. That he came to be not only the high priest, but the sacrifice. And that what we get from that is the ability that we no longer have to fear. This holy God that we deserve to run away, that we should run away from, we can now run toward. That because Jesus got the judgment seat, you get the mercy seat. And I hope that sounds like good news. I hope that's good news to you. It's good news to me. It's good news for the world.
This has been a presentation of Redeemer Presbyterian Church. For more resources and information, please stop by our website at visitredeemer.org. All material here within, unless otherwise noted, copyright Redeemer Presbyterian Church, Elk Grove, California. Music furnished by Nathan Clark George, available at nathanclarkgeorge.com.